Good. Where to?
Well, the only way we can reach that cloud is from inside the brain. So we've decided to put a surgical team and crew into a submarine, reduce it way down in size, and inject it into an artery.
You mean I'm going along?
As part of the crew, yes.
Wait a minute. They can't shrink me.
Our miniaturizer can shrink anything.
But I don't want to be miniaturized.
It's just for an hour.
Not even for a minute. General Carter, sir, I really think you should reconsider your choice. I just don't think I'm the right kind of man for this kind of job.
Brand, you're going to a briefing.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with a little bit of information thrown in on the actors, stories and backgrounds on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps I'll have a half-amusing tale to tell you. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of the plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. We're still continuing January's theme. That is a slate of some really excellent movies that are all about shrinking. Something we call Let's Get Small. And this week, we are screening Richard Fleischer's 1966 classic sci-fi film, Fantastic Voyage. Join us! This week's film is just one that is so unbelievably iconic. It has been parodied ad nauseam, some good, some bad, but all nodding hard to the general excitement and wonder that this film can bring. Now, full disclosure, this is a movie that I saw for the first time probably when I was around the age of 11. And this was back in the day before the Disney Channel was part of the regular cable package. I got to see this on a special Disney weekend preview showing. And you need to understand, at least back in the 80s, before they started making, when I say original content, actual channel original content, and that Disney rebranded themselves, at least as a channel to be for tweens in the late 90s, what was known as the Disney Channel was this very expensive and yet rather poorly programmed premium channel that had to be ordered separately from your standard cable package. Seriously, it was treated like it was something amazing and illicit, something extra special that involved you calling your cable operator on some kind of special 900 number to get access to it. And honestly, back in the day, my poor grandfather, he used to get so angry with the grandkids because he would specifically pay to have HBO, and then he would have to pay extra to have the Disney Channel just available for us to watch when we would all come over. And honestly, what would happen is we would watch movies on HBO when we were over, and then, if there wasn't anything that was kid-appropriate playing, we would then watch either taped Fraggle Rock episodes, or we would watch what was offered on Nickelodeon at the time. And we would completely skip over Disney, mainly because what it offered was so lukewarm. Now again, this was a different time for Disney. Yeah, they had this whole vault of stuff they could have pulled from, but it wasn't really best at programming out blocks of entertainment, at least in the day. So it was really catch-as-catch-can as to what was being offered. If you were lucky, you'd get classic cartoons. But honestly, what I at least recall from the era was a lot of really badly done live-action Winnie the Pooh stuff. It was a rough time. Go back, look it up. But here's the thing. if you didn't have the Disney Channel, it would periodically offer up several times a year weekends or parts of the week where it would be turned on for everybody, so you could get this amazing preview of all this awesome entertainment you could possibly be accessing by paying a lot of money to Disney. And during those special times, Disney would program a lot of interesting things, stuff it didn't actually have access to during the regular 9-to-5 days. A lot of it was film, which, ironically, Disney didn't even own themselves at the time. They would pay to license a lot of content away from 20th Century Fox Studios. Now, again, remember, I'm describing Disney 40 years ago. They hadn't bought Fox yet. And that's how I got to see a bunch of different films. Stuff like 9-to-5, or this technically isn't a Fox film, but I saw it on Disney, Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend. And, once more, this week's film. I remember I got to stay up with my mother, she posted herself on the couch, and we got to watch a group of scientists shrink down and enter a human body to perform a complex surgery. And for the time when I sat to watch this, it blew my mind. So how did this come to being the film that we all know and love today? Well, in 1966, the last gasps of the old dying studio system were still being felt. And 20th Century Fox was attempting to keep its head above water, not stupendously successful in that endeavor. You see, in the early 60s, they had experienced the crushing financial loss that was brought on by having Liz Taylor in Cleopatra, and that all but tanked the studio. It was only through a scant few projects, such as 1962's The Longest Day, Move Over Darling in 1963, and The Sound of Music coming along in 1965, that the studio was in the black enough to be able to keep the lights on. And that allowed at least some time to retrofit and revitalize. Daryl Zanuck, who in the late 1950s had stepped down from running Fox, he'd gone on to become an independent producer. He came back onto the scene and he basically convinced a bunch of fellow producers and board members who owned stock in the company to put forth a vote of no confidence in the current leadership provided by then company head Spiros Skouras. Instead, Zanuck found himself reinstated as the head chairman at 20th Century Fox, and one of his first decisions he made in running the company was he placed it under control of his son, Richard Zanuck. The younger Zanuck is a crazy, crazy character, and both he and his father are going to be subjects for future episodes. But what you really just need to understand right now is the younger Zanuck was far more willing to take cinematic chances, and it was his involvement that would lead the studio into funding some big-budget science fiction films, which would include this week's selection, as well as, in the future, 1968's Planet of the Apes. Both of these films would end up putting Fox back in the black and on healthier footing going into the 1970s. Wanting something different, Fox was looking for a story that could highlight a lot of their in-house talent, and so they settled on a treatment that was derived from authors Jerome Bixby and Otto Clement. It was an adventure story that took place inside the human body. The screenplay was penned by David Duncan, who was already good at writing for science fiction and had already earned a name for himself adapting the amazing 1960 movie, what would become H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. The studio decided that this would be its big budget showcase, and it would be used to highlight what their effects department could do, sort of like an industry inside brag, as well as just use it as a publicity stunt for the emerging project. They publicly started to boast in the trades that this was going to be the most expensive science fiction film they had ever made. Fox had wanted a director who had experience in dealing with projects both of this size and one who was not afraid to wade into certain types of genre. For this day, science fiction was still considered rather B-level fare. You didn't have a lot of big-budget science fiction that would release as an A-class picture. They needed someone old-school, but who was still malleable. They needed someone who was inventive, but at least understood how things needed to work. So they selected one, Richard Fleischer. Now, at this time, Richard Fleischer was not a household name by any stretch, but he was really, really prolific, and he had been around for such a long time, he had managed to make movies both from the height of the studio system through the doldrums of its fall, and then he found new life during the advent of New Hollywood, and ultimately, he would go on to help leave his own mark on the blockbuster days of the 1980s. He could do genre films of all stripes. He did action, noir, comedy, western, science fiction, horror, and he delved into straight-up exploitation. The odds are high you have seen a Fleischer film in your lifetime as a film viewer. He was responsible for 1952's Narrow Margin. He was on board to helm Disney's 1954 epic, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He filmed 1958's The Vikings with Kirk Douglas, Tony Curtis, and one of our favorites, Ernest Borgnine. The man had chops, and he was willing to put his faith in 20th Century Fox's art department to come up with new and innovative ways that they could set this film inside of a human body. Now, under the direction of Bill Abbott, the art department was going to use a melange of practical set work, miniature effects, forced perspective shots, and what was new at the time, blue screen mat work, hoping that all of that together would disguise their dry sets and actually make it appear as if the main cast, as well as a full-on submarine, were actually floating through a human body. A full-size mock-up of the Proteus sub was built, having a complete outside and interior set, allowing the camera to shoot both inside the sub looking out and outside looking in, which creates interesting ways of showing matted backgrounds as the crew is traveling some 100,000 miles through a network of a circulatory system. The crew would actually be suspended by way of wires to be filmed floating across these built sets, and they would be filmed at really high speed, which would then make their movements appear over-exaggerated and floaty when it was slowed down again. And that would be transposed with composite shots and new blue screen technology, and that would impose plasma, blood cells, and other naturally occurring microbes flowing past them, both in the background and in the foreground, to help make it appear as our actors are within a bloodstream. To get those plasma effects, various dyed hues of Vaseline and castor oil were filmed through a very specialized water tank with a camera with a wide lens. That would create, when shooting from a top-down mounted position, the effect that all of these items being released up towards the camera were floating out and around, giving the element of movement of both the sub and the people to make it seem like they were swimming through this melange of various microscopic items. None of this would come cheap. With an initial budget of $6 million to make the film, a total of $4 million would eventually be used only to create the test footage and then to create the sets that would be used on the film. That other $2 million was to cover everything else. When it came to casting, there were three big names that showed up in the film, at least for the time. The first, Edmund O'Brien, he was cast in the role of General Carter. O'Brien was still getting praise for a bunch of the work he had done previously in noir and westerns of the day. He showed up in The Killers in 1946, he was in White Heat in 1949, and he was in Ida Lupino's 1953 excellent cult classic, The Hitchhiker. And, of course, he was seen by so many people in 1962's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Now, one of the others was Stephen Boyd. He was a man who had wowed audiences with his villainous portrayal of Messala in 1959's epic Ben-Hur, starring opposite of Charlton Heston and Jack Hawkins. If you've seen it, he's the guy who's battling in the chariot race against Charlton Heston. He's also the one that gets horribly maimed. It's excellent. Do yourself the favor. Go see it. But last but not least out of that triumvirate was an actor who hadn't yet really come into his own, but Donald Pleasence was on the scene, and honestly, he's one of our all-time faves here, but he was coming in hot off of being part of the ensemble cast that was 1963's The Great Escape. That, and he had just wrapped playing Satan in The Greatest Story Ever Told. Now, to be fair, the film also featured Arthur Kennedy, who was well-known and well-respected for the day, but Arthur Kennedy was almost always, if he was even listed, a second or third banana as a character actor. Again, if he showed up as a name on the poster at all. He was in everything, but he was not a big focus. He just showed up. And honestly, that's not who anybody remembers when it comes to making this film. Nope. Those were the big names I gave to you, but when people think about The Fantastic Voyage, especially if they're of a certain age, and especially if they're males of a certain age, the one name that leaps out is the one and only Raquel Welch. Now, for her part, Welch hadn't done a lot up to this point. She had had a few minor roles in smaller films. She did show up in an Elvis Presley joint, 1964's Roustabout, but honestly, most of Welch's exposure came from modeling work she did and beauty pageants. Her looks got her noticed by producer David Saul's wife, who pointed out to her husband that this is a woman you should get under contract. And right about that time, a big spread she had just done for Life magazine had been published. So Fox had seen the goods and was like, yeah, we need to get this woman to work for us. So they signed a 25-year-old Raquel Welch to a 7-year contract, and they put her in this film, particularly to play as the assistant to Arthur Kennedy's Dr. Duvall. We'll get into that weirdness later. Throw in William Redfield, Jean Delval, and Arthur O'Connell. Oh, and an insanely young James Brolin, who I don't even think he has an actual line of dialogue. He just stands there often and hands things to people as a technician in the room. But all in all, you have a really serviceable cast here to have a microscopic adventure with. Shooting on the film began actually in January of 1965, and all of that would last through June of the same year. There were all kinds of delays brought on by production issues and art issues with how are they going to make this work. 4 massive sets were maintained and were specifically kept together the entire time in case they needed reshoots. Cast members were kept extremely uncomfortable, hung in wire harnesses that they had to wear for all the swimming scenes. They reported to the Daily Variety, at least at the time, that all members were walking away horribly bruised and injured, with Welch getting the worst of it. She had an extreme reaction on one particular bad day on set, where the pressure of her harness forced her to pass out. Even upon completion in June, it would take another 6 months of post-production work before the film would even be ready to be released, and that wouldn't happen for the following year, into the summer of 1966. But folks, I'll tell ya, you've been ever so patient with my prattling on. How's about I shut up and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
You are listening to the sound of a completely new screen experience. A startling new kind of excitement. As 20th Century Fox plunges you into the most incredible adventure that man could ever achieve. To make a motion picture that crosses a new frontier may seem impossible today. Outer space, the depths of the sea, the bowels of the earth, the past, the future, all have been subjects for the camera. But now, a film called Fantastic Voyage has broken through in an unexpected direction to create an adventure of astonishing suspense and beauty.
One of the miracles of the universe.
Its vital news story sweeps down from the sky. Then it drops the bottom out of the world you know and understand. As a beleaguered nation, desperate for survival, launches a journey you can never erase from your memory.
We need you for security purposes, Mr. Grant. They know they failed to kill Benish. Security thinks they'll try again, first chance they get.
A woman has no place on a mission.
I insist on taking my technician.
You take along who I assign.
Don't tell me who I'm going to work with.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, actually entering inside the human body, exploring an unknown universe, unknown dangers.
They're tightening. I can't breathe.
24 seconds left. After that, you're in danger of attack.
Come on, Doctor.
It's sheer suicide for all of us.
You are there with them, sharing a breakthrough in motion pictures.
It's gone.
If you thought it was too late to discover something entirely new on the screen, Fantastic Voyage will be a stunning experience. For you are going where no man or camera has ventured before. And when you come out, you may never look at yourself in the same way again.
Your widest beam, full power.
We open on Czechoslovakian scientist Dr. Jan Beneš, as played by Jean Delval, landing in the United States under the care of one Charles Grant, as played by Stephen Boyd, the CIA agent who successfully got him out of Soviet hands in Europe and delivered him here to the U.S. military in order for the U.S. government to utilize his great intellect and deny the enemy a scientific breakthrough. As soon as Beneš leaves Grant's protection at the airport and is escorted by CIA agents, he is attacked by a team of Soviet assassins who ram his vehicle and open fire upon the car. Beneš is injured in the attack. He slams his head against the interior car door, but CIA agents are able to safely remove him from the vehicle and get him to avoid the subsequent firefight that breaks out. Grant finds himself called back in to report to a top-secret facility by one General Alan Carter, as played by Edmund O'Brien, who briefs him on the new developments happening with Beneš.
Beneš? What the devil happened?
The other side got to him.
How bad off is he?
Brain injuries and a coma.
Before or after what he wanted to tell you?
Before he could breathe a word. He's the only scientist who knows the answer to what we're after. That's why we have to operate, and why we need you.
Me? I can't even put a band-aid on my finger.
Here's the surgeon, Duval. Dr. Peter Duval, top brain man in the country. Have you heard of him?
Sorry, I'm rusty on surgeons. Who's the girl?
Cora Peterson, his technical assistant. You'll be joining Duval and the others.
Well, what can I do? Except maybe pass out.
Mike!
Yes, Alan?
Meet Grant. This is Dr. Michaels, chief of the medical section.
Glad to have you with us, Mr. Grant.
Wish I knew why.
Tell him where he fits in, will you? I've got a few things to check out.
We need you for security purposes, Mr. Grant.
At an operation?
They know they failed to kill Beneš. Security thinks they'll try again, first chance they get. We're afraid of sabotage. Surgical assassination.
Surgical assassination? That means you suspect...
Duval, that's right.
Well, I don't agree. Just because it's often difficult.
Difficult is impossible.
That's no reason to suspect him of disloyalty.
Why take the chance? There must be other doctors.
Duval's the most skillful brain surgeon in the country, and there's no time. Besides, he's right here at hand.
I wouldn't know if he's trying to save him or kill him.
I'll be standing by. I would know.
No matter what happens, you're to take orders only from Dr. Michaels. Understand?
Right, sir.
Carter introduces Grant to Dr. Michaels, as played by Donald Pleasance, who's going to be overseeing the general operation that they're performing on Beneš. Michaels has called in Dr. Peter Duvall, as played by Arthur Kennedy, the top brain surgeon in the country, who is going to be there to help remove a clot that is in Benish's head. But they're rather distrustful of him. You know, he seems to be a man who has opinions. The sort of free-thinking opinions that make him suspicious to these government types. The surgeon is also insisting that he is going to be utilizing his own personal assistant. A woman, no less. One, Ms. Cora Peterson, as played by Raquel Welch, who is going to help him work on Benish. Grant is still confused, though. Why does he need to be involved with any of this? You know, can't they just have a group of folks be in the room while the surgery's taking place, and they can observe and protect Benish there? Confused by the surroundings and by his role, Grant begins to question the general as to why he's even there in the first place. And how come he's never heard of this wacky new acronym they keep throwing about, the CMDF?
I don't mean to be inquisitive, but this CMDF, for all I know, it could stand for the Consolidated Mobilization of Delinquent Females.
Combined Miniature Deterrent Forces.
Say that again.
We can reduce anything down any size we want. People, ships, tanks, planes.
General, I've heard some wild ones, but this takes it.
We can shrink an army with all its equipment, put in a bottle cap. That's why we call it Combined Miniature Deterrent Forces.
If the other side ever gets hold of a thing like that.
They have, but we both have the same problem. Lack of control. They can only keep things miniaturized for exactly 60 minutes. After that, everything starts growing back to its original size.
I assume Benish knows how to control it.
That's right. He wanted us to have the secret, not them. That's why they tried to kill him.
They'll probably try again. No wonder you want me to stand by during the operation.
And take a little trip with it.
The trip, as it's put, will be to load into a high-tech nuclear submarine the medical team, shrink them down, and then inject them into Benish's body. All to remove the clot from inside of his brain, where no surgeon could ever hope to reach by traditional methods of operation. Armed with an experimental cutting laser, Duvall and Peterson will help get rid of the clot, and then the entire group will exit the body altogether. All done under the tight timetable of just 1 hour. Because, of course, after that, the crew will begin to expand and grow back to their original size. That, and if they get too large, that's when Benish's own white corpuscles that protect his body, that's when they will view the presence of the crew and the submarine as a threat to Benish's own system. And then, of course, they'll be attacked and consumed if they don't escape. Grant is going to be in charge of communications as well as security operations for the rest of this team. His background as a diver makes him very much ideal for this mission. While he's reluctant to go through with it, Grant does accept his role, and he heads to the prep area to meet the rest of the team. Dr. Duvall, Ms. Peterson, and Dr. Michaels are all waiting for them, as well as their assigned Navy officer, Captain Bill Owens, as played by William Redfield. He's going to pilot the sub on this strange mission. Colonel Donald Reed, as played by Arthur O'Connell, he spends a lot of this time harumphing instead of briefing people, because honestly, Carter's lost his mind letting a woman go on a mission this dangerous and this important. But Duvall refuses to go without her, so the general backs her inclusion in the project. The whole team gets on board the sub, the Proteus, and prepares to be miniaturized. The process does go fairly smoothly, although Dr. Michaels has a panic attack during the shrinking process, and he needs to be restrained. Later apologizing and sharing with the entire crew that during the war he was buried in rubble for hours. Once they're shrunken down, the ship is injected into Benish and the crew begin their journey, traveling up through his jugular, marveling at the sight of the inner workings of his body.
The medieval philosophers were right. Man is the center of the universe. We stand in the middle of infinity between outer and inner space. And there's no limit to either.
I never imagined it could be anything like this.
I always thought it was nothing but red.
Only to the naked eye. Those corpuscles carrying oxygen give the stream its color. The rest of the plasma is very much like seawater. An ocean of life.
end-to-end 100,000 miles long.
They encounter an arteriovenous fistula, one that is too small to be seen on X-rays, but the pressure it puts on the current forces them to take a detour through Benish's heart, something that threatens to destroy the sub itself. The medical team monitoring them are forced to stop the scientist's heart while the sub races through the maze of chambers, finally making it into Benish's lungs. The ship has taken on some damage, though, from the turbulence that the beating of the heart has caused, and this forces the sub to have lost a large amount of breathable air. The surgical laser has also come undone and was damaged, falling off of its mount during the turbulence, in spite of Peterson strapping it down before the mission even started. Michaels wants to abandon the mission, but Grant talks them into instead running a hose out into the alveoli of the lungs to replace their oxygen. And while he is indeed successful, he almost ends up being sucked out while Benish breathes, his line being mysteriously cut. Upon returning to the sub, Grant finds Duvall attempting to fix the laser, noting that parts of it have been smashed. Grant agrees to cannibalize transistors from the radio set, but that's going to cut off their communications with headquarters. Dr. Michaels again reluctantly agrees, and Grant takes him aside to share some suspicions.
So far, someone's tried to sabotage this mission twice.
Sabotage? I don't quite understand.
I saw the laser just before we started. It was fastened on securely. You don't suppose what happened was an accident? Any more than my safety line snapping after it was tied off to the sub?
Surely you don't seriously suspect, Duvall.
That line was tampered with.
Oh, I don't know what to say. Well, I know he's under a cloud, but there's not a more dedicated man in the entire medical profession.
You still never know what's going on in anyone's mind.
I don't believe it, but I'll have to make it.
Two in a row.
It's possible.
They decide to make up for lost time and are forced to travel through the lymphatic system and make their way up to Benish's ear, having to endure horrific turbulence as noise from the outside ends up rocking the sub. But again, in spite of the hardship, the crew survives. The sub, though, begins to stall out. Fibers that they've picked up along the way through the lymphatic system have clogged the air intakes, causing the crew once again to get out of the vehicle and attempt to clear it off, allowing their engines to pull forward. In doing so, antibodies begin to attack them, almost crushing Miss Peterson to death. Getting things back under control, the Proteus finally reaches the clot inside of the brain. With only about 6 minutes left to spare, they suddenly find themselves arguing with Dr. Michaels, who wants to abandon the mission rather than save Benish.
We'd better get prepared.
There just isn't time. I don't see how you could possibly operate and get out of here before the hour's up. Captain, you'd better head for the removal point.
Removal point? What are you talking about?
Well, we've only 6 minutes left. We'll just barely make it.
Hold it, Skipper. What happens if we overstay?
Once time's up, deminiaturization begins. Then within a matter of seconds, the ship will grow big enough to become a danger to the system. Then white corpuscles will swarm to destroy it, as they would any other invader.
Skipper, how long will it take us to get from here to the removal point?
About 2 minutes.
That still leaves me 4 minutes to operate.
All you'll succeed in doing is getting us trapped. I simply won't hear of it.
Captain, return immediately to the removal point.
All right.
Grant ends up taking control and cuts the sub's power, giving Dr. Duvall and Cora time to use the laser to eliminate the clot, all over Dr. Michael's protests, noting that this entire time, Duvall has been trying to help Benish, as opposed to Dr. Michael's behavior. Michaels has stayed inside the Proteus, where he incapacitates Captain Owens and attempts to run the crew down and escape with the sub, leaving them all behind. Grant ends up taking the laser and damages the vehicle, causing it to crash and become entangled in a bank of nerves. Duvall and Grant enter to find an injured Captain Owens, and where they attempt to unsuccessfully extract the now pinned Dr. Michaels. The time limit has been reached, and the crew and the ship are now starting to expand, which causes the white corpuscles in the body to take notice of their presence, and try as they might, they can't remove Dr. Michaels. The crew watches in horror as Michaels and the top part of the sub are engulfed and consumed by a hungry corpuscle. The remaining crew desperately swim down the optic nerve, where they begin to expand further, exiting Benish's body through a tear duct, and are caught on a waiting slide put there by the general. The crew then slowly regains their size, and they are hailed as heroes by the CMDF staff, all while credits roll. So where do we begin? Well, here, let's start with what's good. As a concept, and in putting this film into context as to when it was made, the movie looks phenomenal. It's a really great mix of practical and visual effects that keep the story moving and allow for both a friendly, yet still sort of unsettling, collage of colors and strange sights to freak out the average viewer. As characters go, almost everyone here is just basically a walking trope. We don't really get into a ton of backstory. But we have the added benefit of framing the story around Grant, because he serves as the stand-in for the audience on this trip. Everybody here is really smart, so he's sort of just there to make sure things go smoothly and work the radio. So as that non-medical professional, he gets to be the dummy in the room, and they can dump a bunch of information about the human body on him, explaining how it works, where they're going, how they're going to get from point A to point B, and that makes it more believable to us, the audience, because we get to hear it from Grant's perspective. Now, Donald Pleasance is the real star with his quiet intensity and his general awkwardness. But he does essentially telegraph to anybody with half a brain that, yes, I'm really the problem, I'm really the saboteur. He is not entirely subtle with the portrayal. I'm sure that was told to him by the director, especially when you see him interacting in the beginning with Captain Owens, where he's asking him, how do you pilot the sub? Hey, where is that stuff located? How do I access that? It's pretty obvious he's being super nosy when everyone else is doing their job. Although I have to say, his motivations for stopping things seem kind of dubious. You know, you're working with, or you're trying to stop things because you don't want the Russians to lose this research, even though you work for the U.S. government, who's paying you for this very research you're working on. It just seems like silly. Why would you want to deny yourself the thing that you've been forwarding? It's not the most fleshed out of concepts, but to his credit, Pleasance gives this proper level of detachment, just enough to be really weird and off-putting, and at the end of the day, that makes him a really great villain. For a film that takes place entirely in the body, the violence here is indeed bloodless, but I gotta say, watching Dr. Michael scream as his head is enveloped and then starts to be dissolved by this large cotton ball looking white corpuscle, it's still a disturbing sight to take in. This is a film, too, that, at least as important as the concept of time is in regards to this story, really plays it kind of fast and loose with how long things take. They are constantly getting stopped, and, you know, they spend 10 minutes here in a location, and then they, of course, check back with the clock to announce that they still have X minutes remaining. And even though they do this, we the audience can already tell, hey, you guys have far less time than that. Now, granted, I'm not offended by this at all, but it does get kind of ludicrous, especially at the end, when Duvall is told, well, we have less than 6 minutes to operate and get out of Benish's body, and they spend a good 4 minutes on the ship debating how much time 6 minutes is, and that's before they even exit the sub. That's laughably funny to me. A hard part about watching this film now, though, well, it regards Raquel Welch. To be fair, Welch has always been, in my mind, a perfectly fine actress. There is nothing wrong here. She is doing her best with the part that is given, and honestly, whenever she's been given something of substance to work with, she does great. Here, though, in this film, like all of the other actors, she's just kind of a prop. She is a bit of eye candy here for the men to argue about. First, because, well, it's so outrageous that a woman would ever be involved in a top-secret kind of mission like this. Again, it's the 60s, not saying that's the right way to approach it. As well as the fact that, you know, everyone here is so qualified and speaks about how accomplished she is, but her qualifications are just sort of glossed over. She's just Dr. Duvall's assistant, and what's kind of worse is they kind of intimate that she's only there because clearly there's something going on between her and Dr. Duvall, and it's this weird sexist undertone that kind of permeates everything. Now, the film doesn't flesh it out very much, not like the way the novelization does, but it's another example, at least, where a story has, of course, a young male protagonist and one of the female protagonists. They're supposed to, of course, become attracted and fall in love with each other, and, you know, everybody gets to live happily ever after when it's over. Yeah. The film mercifully kind of glosses over that. We're given slight hints, and it sort of intimates that there is an attraction here, but the interactions themselves don't really progress beyond that point. Instead, we're left with weird sexist exchanges, kind of like this.
Bet you're pretty handy around the house. Can you cook?
We're pushing oxygen today.
I'll have some laughing gas, ma'am.
You sound as if you're not looking forward to it.
It's not exactly a pleasure cruise, you know.
I think it's very exciting. We're going to see things no one has ever seen before. Not just something under a microscope. Think about it.
That's the trouble I have. Being shrunk.
You may learn to like it. Excuse me.
You're a nice young lady. You play with the damnedest toys, Miss Peterson.
That'll teach you where to keep your hand.
Now I know. That could be quite a lethal weapon. It could kill, not cure.
Not in the hands of a great surgeon like Dr. Duvall. The beam from this laser can be regulated to 1/1,000,000 of a millimeter.
I understand you've been Dr. Duvall's assistant for quite some time. He must have snatched you out of a cradle.
I've been with him since I got out of school. He brought me into the CMDF over 5 years ago.
A long time with one man.
Not working with someone like Dr. Duvall. He's... well.
Now, look, I'll say this. I'm no prude. And hey, if you've kept up with this show at all and you've seen some of the other exploitation things we've covered here in the past, it's pretty much established. I'm not one who's going to shy away from a bit of the sauciness, dare I say, even lewd scenery, when it comes to motion pictures. But I said that to say this. In watching this film now as an adult, when Cora is attacked by those antibodies and she's dragged back into the sub to remove those proteins that are constricting and choking her, the only thing that was running through my mind was how unnecessary that scene felt, or at least how it was shot. All four men on board the Proteus drop everything that they're doing to collectively surround and just run their hands over Raquel Welch's form. You know, to remove those constricting antibodies to help. But in watching it today, it just feels like all of the actors on set got together and conspired with the director. We need a way that all of us can grope on Raquel Welch. Again, in a film with a PG offering, that seemed to be the best way they could do it. And it's another aspect of this film that just doesn't age well when you watch it again. Now, I'll tell you this. Again, I like this movie. It's got a lot of imagination, and it keeps what should be a rather silly concept, a distant background thought, since the journey you're on is really fun. But I'll freely admit, and it's going to be a hard sell when it comes time for me to sit down with nieces and nephews and try to get them to sit and watch this, because, well, they're not old enough yet to watch it without it being kind of frightening. Because, again, the effects for the day, they're kind of dated. I mean, I can't imagine the older kids wanting to sit there. My eldest niece right now is probably right around the age I was when I first saw it. And in my head, I can already hear, "Uncle Chris, why are we watching a bath toy travel through a lava lamp?" It's true. I mean, the methods that were used were revolutionary for the time, but we have lapped them so hard, even just a few years after the film was made. With greater perfection from blue screen technology and effects, there are some scenes clearly where you can see the wires that the actors are suspended by. But I'll tell you that, I get it, it is dated now. But the argument remains true. Since you get a feeling of wonder as you watch this film, it is able to invoke such awe and such fun. That all remains here. And I think that viewers, at least even ones in this jaded time who are used to watching things that are made with CGI, they're able to at least sort of hold on to that suspension of disbelief and keep enjoying the film for what it is. And that's an interesting and fun journey through something that everyone is familiar with, but most of us have never gotten a chance to see it for ourselves, the inner workings of our own beings. And that, for me at least, makes this something worth taking in. So I can hear you now. Chris, how was the film received? Well, from a critic's side of things, quite well. Fantastic Voyage was both a critical and, for the most part, a commercial success. We'll get into it a little later, but still, it garnered a lot of praise back in the day. Box Office Magazine hyped up the project. Neither the word fantastic nor any of its synonyms can properly describe the charted course of this deluxe color cinemascopic voyage. Preposterous though its premise is, the incredible aspects are soon forgotten as the optic splendors of the anatomical inner world unfold. Pretty solid, I would argue, right? Murph, that lovable grump over at Variety, he was equally kind with his assessment, noting that this film was excellent, entertaining, a sci-fi suspender about a trip into a living body by miniaturized scientists that should do very well at the box office with outstanding production values. Alright, he's on board. Shockingly, even that old grand dam of the theater, favorite punching bag of mine, Bosley Crowther, over at the New York Times, he liked the movie. Although he still had to coat his praise with his usual pretentious bile, and he still managed to insult and be sexist towards Welch, noting that she is the most pneumatic-looking thing in a skin suit on screen. More shocking, though, in his review, he gave away the ending of the movie, all in an attempt to speak as to how the film doesn't have to inherently be good when the story is so compelling and interesting like we have here. Thanks, I guess? But there were some detractors even back in the day. R.M. Hodgins from the Film Quarterly did not get this movie. Really, he didn't get any of it. He writes, "I'm afraid it is fantastic," noting that it's explained in advance that the white corpuscles will attack growing objects, and they do. But what could a white corpuscle do to a submarine? That worries me. So does the lighting here, the color, the process shots, and some of the sets. They hardly measure up to the real bodily interiors that we see in the probing lenses on flexible tubing of Corpse Profonde. The script is done by a lot of people, and Richard Fleischer directed. I don't know about them, but he can do better. So, if I'm understanding Mr. Hodgins' point, he's upset that this is not set in a real, honest-to-God body, and he instead is comparing this work of fiction, the sets that were built, and the acting here to an actual medical documentary that was filmed that allowed people to look inside of a real person during surgery. That's the comparison we're making? Doesn't seem quite fair. In the end, that wouldn't much matter. Audience members came along for the ride, and by the end of its run, Fantastic Voyage had had a decent amount of box office business. They had done about $8 to $8.5 million against that initial budget of $6 to $6.5 million, depending on how you factor international showings. It did make more money back, though, when the dust settled and the funny accounting was through. Box office numbers would later be adjusted to having the film make over $12 million when all was said and done. Still not a Titanic hit, but things were kept in the black. Nobody had any issues. The film itself would be honored with two Academy Awards, one for Best Art Direction and one for Best Special Effects. But the popularity of the film, which really boosted it for both future television and video sales, would have help from another factor, and that would be the hype surrounding one Raquel Welch. You see, Fantastic Voyage, it was winding down its time in the summer of 66, and the follow-up project that Raquel Welch had was a little movie that she found herself working on when she was loaned out to Hammer Studios, a movie called 1 Million Years BC, and that came out the following year. Really cemented and crystallized by that iconic image of Welch in the cavewoman outfit. You know, she's rocking that deerskin bikini. You know, the poster that they use in The Shawshank Redemption. That was the guiding principle to get a bunch of young men to try to go out and see this movie because they saw her in that one. And that got people to continue to talk about Fantastic Voyage. Now, it had other help, too. The novelization of the film was done by popular science fiction author Isaac Asimov, and that would allow the story to remain a bit of pulpy fun and inspire new generations of readers to both discover the story and then go and watch the film themselves. Going forward, Richard Fleischer, he'd have a ton of more interesting movies that he would make during his career. He would ping-pong back and forth. He had box office bombs and box office hits. He did Dr. Doolittle, Soylent Green, Tora, 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 The Last Run, Mr. Majestic, heck, Conan the Destroyer, and that's just naming a few. His career would remain varied and interesting. What about the film itself? What it inspired? That would continue on too, and that would further add to the movie's cult status. Hell, let me be honest, next week's movie is just a spoof on this very concept of this film. And seriously, how many TV shows, if you can close your eyes and think about it right now, ape this very concept of shrinking and going into another character's body? I can tell you right now, just stuff I've seen. Rugrats, Magic School Bus, Futurama, Simpsons, Regular Show, Archer, Rick and Morty. And again, I'm only naming stuff I've seen for myself. This has been done over and over and over again. Spoofed, given homage to, and outright ripped off. This is and remains a story that we all are collectively familiar with, even when we haven't seen the source material, which I would argue is a testament to the mark that this film has made in popular culture. Now, many a remake and a sequel have been planned for this film. Every 5 to 10 years or so, it feels like some new rumor crops up that they're going to do it again, and each time, it's attached to the newest director of the month. Great. On one hand, I'll believe it when I see it. And on the other hand, I would say it's a movie that, yeah, again, while its effects are dated and the acting is a little wooden, it still works and it's still a lot of fun. And I don't really think it needs to be remade because it's not inherently a bad picture that needs to be saved from itself. Being a little dated does not make something inherently wrong. And in the case of Fantastic Voyage, there's a lot of right to work with. The version of Fantastic Voyage, screened here at the LSCE, was the 2013 Blu-ray release from 20th Century Fox. If you were to go on Amazon.com right now, that same version is available for the very low price of $12.99. And for that, you get the film itself, commentary from film historian Jeff Bond, musical track commentary from Jeff Bond, John Burlingame, and Nick Redman. You get Lava Lamps and Celluloid, which is a featurette tribute to the visual effects of the Fantastic Voyage. A storyboard to scene comparison for the whirlpool scene, plus the original theatrical trailer and TV spots, which, again, for $12.99, not too shabby if you ask me. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where to purchase your films from. We just feel in this day and age, it's ever so important to continue to support physical media, to show these fine studios who own the rights to the pictures that we're interested in, that we indeed want more of the content that they have access to. And truly, at the end of the day, isn't that your goal? To get more of the content that you know and love released for your enjoyment? Besides, Fantastic Voyage is a certified cult classic. You would be missing out to have not seen such a fine film for yourself. So, on that note, what are you waiting for? Get out there, get yourself a copy of Fantastic Voyage today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSC, Dachshunds, and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts. Hit that subscribe button, tell a friend, or hey, just please do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. Just please think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please swing by, check out our website, that would be lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm proud to say we're on Amazon Music, so if you have an account, you can just say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. You can find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could please. And hey, feel free to do that to any of the lists that we're a part of, just to give us a little boost in the old rankings. You see, the more reviews and the increased likes, that affects all those marvelous algorithms, and that makes us more searchable. And then we can share these fine films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! If you have any questions for us, comments, movies you want me to cover, things you think I got wrong, we'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email or an audio message to lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Yeah, we'll use it here. You can find us on Twitter at LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. You can find us on Facebook. Join the group. See what movies we're watching in real time. If you'd like to be even more personable, or you wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, please send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app for you to use. So until next time, please, everybody, take care out there. Wash your hands, wear a mask, stay healthy. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.